No, no, we got cut off there, Ken. Sorry.
Okay,
we were reaching the 10,000 hours.
Yes.
Okay, look. Jonathan, will I tell him about Dan McLaughlin and the 10,000 hours?
Can you give him the short story?
Okay. The short story, there's this young American guy, sold a business in order to free himself up to devote his life to an academic question.
Okay.
Right? Connected with a university, right?
Right.
Fully based in there, right? The question, he's a living case study in testing the 10,000 hours theory.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
He's got a golf coach. He has got a, he's practicing. He's 2,800 hours in. His success will be playing on the US PGA.
Yeah.
Have you ever hit a golf ball in your life?
Yes.
Okay.
But I don't know.
Have you ever missed a one-foot putt?
I don't think so, but I've only probably had two of those in my life. I've played par three about once in my life and pitch and putt twice. So I've only had three times I've actually moved with a golf ball.
Do you know last week a woman had a 1 foot putt to win one of the biggest women's golf tournament?
And there's Scottsburg.
And she missed it.
Wow.
Back to 10,000 hours. Dan McLaughlin is practicing this. We have built a relationship with Dan McLaughlin, Jonathan and myself, and we are striving really, really hard to bring Dan McLaughlin to Ireland, and not just Ireland, but certainly to bring him across the Atlantic.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
He is connected already himself, partly through this, with Matthew Syed, author of Bounce.
Okay.
Which is all about, written by a British table tennis champion.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
All about the 10,000 hours thing. So that's why I sort of brought... Why did I mention Dan McLaughlin anyway? Ryder Cup.
Ryder Cup.
It would be, of course, be wonderful if Dan McLaughlin... He has weekly blog, audio blog, video blog, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's a whole series of... he's got a
following. There's a guy, I don't mean... Just The Guardian did a special a while ago was on how you could become competitive in a sport. Obviously the Chinese idea of what they do as a nation. So they pick sports that people either don't do that well, or
table tennis,
or are out of vogue, like weightlifting, female weightlifting. You know, it's a less cluttered space, and then they just invest shitloads of resources.
So they're trying to win medals
in less decluttered sports, whereas trying to win medals in Olympic level boxing, that's going to be hard. Going to be really hard. Because also
they're trying to win the most medals.
I think, and it's also just as well. Be able to demonstrate that, you know, we're the world leaders in this, but like in the same way that you can be the world leader in X, but if it's quite small and localized, it's not really meaningful. So I'm particularly interested in how, see, this Guardian guy said he decided about time, could he become an expert in a couple of sports that don't require maybe huge genetic endowments to do well in, and he tried darts and snooker as examples. And he's got a really nice series of articles on the amount of time and effort he put into trying to get good at darts and snooker.
Did he come up with a figure?
I don't know. I actually forget it. He also was a TV critic he was also trying to become. Because he reckoned that would take fewer hours to develop an expertise in.
Let me tell you an extraordinary story straight out of Matthew Syed's book, Bounce, right? Desmond Douglas, right? The first British world champion in table tennis, right? In the mid-1980s, I think 1987, right? Had a reputation for being the most powerful player over the table in table tennis. Literally, you know how in table tennis you could stand away from the table or up the table. Anyway, so much so that the Chinese even got a bit scared of him. He was so damn strong over the table, right? And Matthew Syed investigated why Desmond Douglas was so good over the table. What was it? What was the reason? And the amazing thing he discovered was that Desmond Douglas grew up in a very unprivileged background with a shed, and the parents got a table tennis table.
Not much room for no room to back their way.
Right in one, absolutely right. There was no room at the front and back, right? So he developed the most extraordinarily strong and fast reflexes over the table in that shed.
There's an aggregate
Let me just finish the bit, because this is where it becomes extraordinary. So he got really strong there. The theory was that Desmond Douglas must have developed, as a result of this, the fastest reflexes in the world.
Yeah.
So they did an experiment. They set Desmond Douglas up on a machine in which they would flash a light and he would then have to react, right? Yeah. And they discovered that he had slower than average reaction time. In fact, Desmond Douglas didn't have exceptionally fast reaction time, and he was slower than average. Question, how is this possible? Amazing, amazing answer to this emerged, right? That reactions are context-based.
Yeah.
In other words, Desmond Douglas has become more mentally agile at reading the body signals of the person across the table than anybody else in the history of table tennis of all time, right? But Desmond Douglas is not reacting to the ball after it's hit.
Yeah,
he's
yeah.
reacting to the signals that you're giving off across the table when you're getting ready to service me.
Yeah.
So it also turns out, and just to kind of keep going for one last second, chess masters able to play 100 games simultaneously and memorize the positions blind,
not necessarily
cetera,
the grandmaster
right?
who they can be.
Well, wait a second. They can do it if the positions are standard chess positions, but if you start making the positions random assemblies of the chess pieces, they're incapable of remembering. So their ability to remember is their ability to, whatever the phrase is, you know, contextualize the experience. So they're able to link clunking or chunking
is what it's called.
Chunking,
Jeffrey Miller.
Sorry, what were you going to say?
No, that's exactly it. Well, two things going on. One, there's a book by, I forget the name of the author, on Dutch football, and his argument was Dutch footballers are better by European standards than anyone else because they grow up in a country of about 15 million people.
We're talking about Johan Cruyff.
Yeah, with very few green spaces, and they become street footballers, but in very small spaces, so they develop tight control naturally long before they actually start playing in teams. So that's just one. It's almost a bit like pathetic fallacy in literature. So the landscape affects the thought. The idea was that the landscape affects actually what you bring, literally what you bring to the table. The other thing I'm also struck by when you say that is, like, it's kind of well known that Haile Gebrselassie was, I don't think, ever held a 10,000 meter world record. Because,
did he not?
No, I don't think so, ever. I'd probably go pub quiz on that, but he has more gold medals. Because if you're going for a world record attempt, you do it outside of the games, and you do it with a bunny. Is that what they call their hair?
A runner.
Probably a bunny, I think is what they call it.
Okay,
where someone paces you, a pacemaker. Where they pace you.
Yeah.
And the Kenyans were brilliant at this. But what I actually found is the guy who was the fastest 10,000 meter guy of maybe late 90s, early 90s, when it came to Gebrselassie on his shoulder, psyching him out, loses it. So Gebrselassie was not the quickest for that distance, but he's the best mind player. And you see that again in velodrome cycling. It's who goes slower for the first lap. Usually can get it. So it's about gamesmanship and brinkmanship and then psyching and going for it. So this person missed the 1 foot putt. You know, I'd probably get it, but that's because, but then I'd miss it. I wouldn't even get onto the green beforehand. But it's actually, the execution becomes, the margin of error is so small, and maybe the data they have from previous experience is so much that they actually need to strip it away to the absolute basics. And they can't do that because they have so many memories and kinesthetic memories of other golf balls they've hit. Whereas they actually just need to step up like a naive person and tap it 1 foot.
The empty mind.
Yeah.
The empty
exactly.
mind.
Leave your history behind when you're actually faced with one moment where you're not against an opponent.
Okay, so let's come back to our social situation in Ireland. How can we leave our history behind then?
very difficult. They're very, very difficult. I think actually some of the stuff we've talked, one is education has begun to change things. Two, our education at university level is definitely better than what it was 10 or 15 years ago.
Thank goodness, I have a 6-year-old daughter and I'm highly dependent upon people like you. How old are your children?
6 and 8.
Right, so we have a vested interest, have we not?
Yeah, I think that's good. And the other thing is, we've got this human capital that has been built up and sometimes partly dismantled by some of the great multinationals coming in who've actually forced people to upskill and learn new skills. And when they go, it is to leave a skill base. So, and add to that then...
Is it good for them to leave, actually, and let us take away the...
I don't think it's that edifying that the best people I would teach, if they want to work in consulting or high-end management performance for the Big Four or in accounting or whatever, I like the idea of someone saying startup is good enough, working with four or five people, I learn a lot more skills. I'll be shown the deep end. These places have very good onboarding procedures, of course they have, but I still think it's great to see young people not being employees and actually being co-creators, and that's really helpful. And I think we have a tendency, well, the political class...
Could I please have an Americano?
Yeah. Could I just get... same, please. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, we finished. Thank you ever so much. That was a most wonderful, wonderful pizza.
Joyous.
In fact, it was just fantastically good.
There you go. Thanks a lot. Cheers. So... Oh, you're going now.
Yeah. No, it's fine. Good.
So... You're going into the creative destruction hypothesis there. I think I'd like to see us be able to, let's take Amazon. So ad agencies seem to be pursuing brands that advertise on TV. That's what they're going for. That's where the money is. And that's been mainlanded, if you want to use it, in the UK. My sense is, why aren't we doing more advertising or branding work or persuasion for SMEs in Ireland? You know, why aren't we doing that? They're out there. Why aren't we approaching them? Are we just waiting to? Are we waiting in train stations for trains to go that aren't going to run anymore? We need to. I think the Irish ad industry is too reliant on, let's go for the big client with their very clear marketing manager, marketing unit, then reporting into the C-suite, and there's eight of them a year come for grabs or whatever.
Imagine a marketing agency, a branding agency that deliberately went out, found a way of taking out an equity stake instead of cash.
This is, totally agree with this. And totally, you know, this is perfect. I love this.
Imagine
stuff.
An agency that could get itself 50
I would say you get
a year. Some of them would strike it rich.
Exactly.
And you would get...
Yeah. And it's also going back to the idea you give the work away. So I think it's still quite important that you do... In other words... My material impact on Unilever is not going to be that much. Unilever have thought every thought I've had, apart from the academic stuff, when it comes to consumers. They generally have. I like this idea, when, to use a football analogy, when Dennis Bergkamp was sold, his first big move from Ajax, he had the choice of going to AC Milan or Inter Milan. And AC would have been just coming out of their Hullet Rijkaard era, and it was still an incredible team. And he said when he went to Inter, he'd go there because they needed him more than AC Milan needed him. Now, it didn't really work out. They also bought his friend Wim Jonk, and he didn't really succeed in Inter. And then Bruce Rioch brought him to Arsenal, and the rest is history. Well, I like this idea that how will you have impact? And I think we have a lot of people queuing up to service these multinationals who are behemoths, who will never de-invent themselves. They'll always be there. But we're very comfortable with that in advertising. I think it's actually quite, you know, if you have a good 20-minute chat about something with somebody who doesn't know where you're coming from and needs a bit of a pep, when it comes to advertising and branding, that's really helpful. You actually have an impact.
That's a legacy conversation, isn't it?
Yeah. When you're interviewed later on, you say, I remember once meeting someone for coffee and they said this. Well, you didn't really get those chats when you interview them head of Procter & Gamble or something.
Well, imagine yourself a bit like, imagine you are Steve Jobs and you basically met somebody in 1981 and you had a cup of coffee with them and you had a chat.
Yeah.
And you're the guy who I had a chat with. I mean, your life has been changed, haven't they?
Yeah.
Well, that's actually what happened. He met Lee Klo, who was a top creative director, and he met a South African guy called Peter Economides, who was an account director. And this is like in 1981. They went to his house. They didn't know how to dress, so they kind of thought, we better dress casual, and arrived, and Steve was there in shorts.
Very casual.
No shoes, no socks. And that's how they got started, thinking about how to apply creativity. But it was interesting because I think as a business owner, he recognized how he could use creativity, not just in how to communicate, but also in terms
in
of how to engineer.
And
I think, I mean, if you listen to Steve Jobs talking about branding in the 90s even, I mean, he's talking about stuff that today people are only figuring out.
That's right, yeah.
Which is amazing. So he was totally ahead of his time.
Exactly. There's a nice book out called by Roger Martin called The Design of Business. He's a professor in Rotman in Toronto. It's the idea of how do you bring design-led thinking into everything you do, including new product development. The consultant that makes a lot of money in this is Ideo, or Ideo. It's just a really good... But it's still, exactly. This stuff was being done by Jobs and Apple implicitly. And now people are beginning to learn about it now, and maybe we've already gone past that phase, has become mainstreamed, and we need something else to think about. But there's always this, you know, slowdown before the ideas come back in again.
But that's what's interesting, if you think of it, like, IDEO,
thank you very much.
Thank you. Well, IDEO doesn't have a monopoly on how to think.
Yeah, exactly.
But what's interesting is that a lot of, I think what ad agencies and branding companies have done well is that they know how to plot the process to get the client from, you know, A to Z, literally.
Yeah.
But how do you apply that same kind of process thinking, not just to the communication side, but to the actual innovation side, to actually help SMEs develop disruptive products, new ways of thinking?
Okay. I just delivered to a client last week, my own client. It's not the agency's client. I won't mention the AR for the moment. But I came up with this idea called an NPD lab. New product development lab, and so it was a day of it was my first experiment with it, but it was a day that was structured and will get more structured over time. But how do you use individual level insights around thinking, creativity, and innovation, bolt them on to structural processes that companies need to have to maximize innovation? So how do you actually really get, you know, brainstorming to actually do a job for you rather than just being excused to have a cup of tea? How do you take on board what's normally assumed to be like what the muse does for you? How do you begin to think about doing things around that actually are Tuesday mornings? They are Monday mornings. They're not, you're not just cycling by somewhere and you get an idea. That, there's always going to be room for that. But what companies need is, how do I bring that? How do I force all these ideas to bend together when I'm in a meeting, when I need them, when I need them with my engineering team?
But it's interesting how it's a cross-discipline way of thinking. I mean, it's almost like the analytical management consulting thinking in terms of process, but also the highly creative thinking.
Exactly.
So it's kind of like inductive-deductive kind of working together.
And
But I think that's where often consultants struggle, because they're either hyper-creative, selling the feel-good, you know, we're going to do something exciting feeling, versus being overly analytical. So how do you, and it's almost like getting those two thinking modalities right, and doing it in a way that's experiential with clients, so that they actually
I agree. Here's one mechanism that's a good way of, if I'm going to do this again, and I will do it again, hopefully, is one of the ways of doing is build a team of different talents. So when you're co-presenting and co-designing the workshop, pick somebody who doesn't think like you to do that. So then you're embedding another way of thinking into how you design the program, and maybe you'll co-present it with that person as well. The second one, though, is to always go, it goes back to this 10,000 hours. 10,000 hours is fine, but it doesn't mean you're going to end up like Lionel Messi either. He's just got a way of doing stuff that you just don't see. Patterns. Pattern detection and pattern acting on those patterns. So what I think is very helpful is, how do you get comfortable enough with, in other words, if you're going to break rules, you need to know what the rules are in the first place. I meet a lot of creative people or consulting types who kind of don't really know the rules about the history, the process, the rigidity of ways of making things. They don't understand, for example, the history of technologies or the history of industry or the history of economics. So when they say we can do it this way, that way, actually, no, you can't. It's never been done like that before for a reason. And I think so. I think there are ways of, you've got to inform yourself about what are the parameters. Once you know them, you can then set yourself up for when you are facilitating you, I'm leaving those parameters now and I'm going to go back in. Too many people just say, here's the way it is and go for it, like the 4-hour work week. You know, it's easy to say that when you've already made your million. Back in the 4-hour work week when you're on 10 grand a year is a lot harder. So I think you need to know your rules before you flout them. And I think a lot of people in consulting have to think there and know these set of rules, as you were talking about this rigid process one, or you get a very creative person who can't really explain how to come up with their ideas.
And you see that in the advertising industry.
Oh, really?
You see the creatives bouncing, you know, going tangential.
Yeah.
You know, the suit's trying to bring them back. The strategic thinker's trying to control.
Yeah.
They're fighting against that control. And it's interesting. I mean, I think that industry...
Did you have a hard time in those days when you were
advertising agency? Not at all. I mean, it's great, because that's where you need that friction within that space to generate the ideas. And I think that's a challenge in terms of, like, conventional... business in Ireland is that a lot of it is totally homogenous in terms of its thinking. So people have, in many respects, been to the same schools, been through the same academic institutions, been taught in a certain way. And I think that's what's healthy, even in terms of, like, migration into Ireland.
And as a South African who's migrated into Ireland, you speak with experience.
Absolutely. I mean, 12% now of Irish people are non-nationals. And I think, I mean, you can see it. You can see it in schools now. I mean, that is, from a sociological perspective, shaping, reshaping
this
thinking.
This could be why Scotland's in trouble. Scotland has very low internal migration rates.
And I think that's something that Ireland needs to work on, is how does it encourage migration, not just for the sake of a